I call the House Transportation meeting to order, and it is about 8 minutes after 1:00. And let the record show that the following House members are present: Vice Chair Isaacson, Representative Lynn, and Representative Christ Tompkins, and myself, Representative Wilson.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Gaddis.
Representative Gaddis versus Lynn.
I'm sorry.
No worries. there is a distinct difference.
Yes.
Just want to say that for the record.
Especially on this committee.
And Madam Chair, we'll probably be joined by Representatives Lynn and Feige as they're finishing up with Joint Armed Services.
Ah, okay. So that tells us that Feige and
Lynn.
And Lynn will be down. They're in another committee right now, and so they'll be joining us shortly. And before we start, again, please, the people that are in the audience, if you would shut off your phones, or if you have airplane mode, you can switch them to airplane mode. And today we're bringing back two bills that we've previously heard, and House Bill 260. We'll just wait so we can get the commotion quieted down here.
Sorry,
because
melts over here.
And House Bill 271, feasibility study to extend the railroad to Dead Horse. So we do have, and Representative Isaacson, if you want to go and present your bill, you wanted to go on around, so we'll let you do that. We do have the CS for the bill. And the bill is, we're going to hear House Bill 260 first, and we have a CS version R. And do we have anybody to move that motion forward? And it's the CS for House Bill 260 version R.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gaddis.
There you go. I move the CS for, and I'm sorry, I don't have that documentation in front of me.
House Bill 260.
For House Bill 260 version
R.
Forward.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And do I hear?
And I do have version R.
And having hearing no objections, so we have that working document before us now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does that mean I don't have to present because there's no objection? It's just going to carry?
No. I don't think so.
For the record, I'm Representative Doug Isaacson, representing Districts 1, at Eielson and North Pole. And I'm thankful that you are hearing this bill and have adopted a work draft, as we just did. House Bill 260, as originally framed, was trying to solve a specific issue, and it was the movement of smaller intrastate commercial vehicles by dealers from Anchorage to their point of sales elsewhere in the state. Issues raised last week regarded an unfair competitive advantage for in-state upfitters, which made us go back to the drawing boards, ask the attorneys and such, to see if there was an easier way to handle the issue. And there was a question also about the DOT inspection, and we raised an initial mention about CDLs. The commercial driver's license does not really enter in to any of this until you get to 26,000 pounds. And what we resolved was to just simplify this, clarify it for DOT regulation issues, inspection issues, avoid the interstate commerce possible feud. And so we just said we're going to do 19,500 pounds. And last week I showed you what 19,500 pounds looks like. It's an essentially it's a Ford 550 or Ram or Chevy equivalent. And it is a vehicle that is a pickup that has the back, the flatbed or box van instead of a pickup bed. There are no air brakes. It's a truck like many of us drive.
Okay.
So with that, Madam Chair.
I do want to clarify that a little bit.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is you stopped at that weight, and the reason you stopped at that weight because the air brakes were on anything over that weight.
Yes, and to avoid any, Madam Chair, to avoid any other issues that might arise, stopping at 19.5 cured the problem for many different user groups, whether they were our dealers, which was specifically what I was aiming for, or later on as it was identified for us, agriculture or whatever other applications might use this in their own personal use.
Okay. Any other questions? I do have, actually, I did not close testimony last time, and just so that we do have a couple people online that will kind of clarify that a little bit further, so I think it would be good to hear from them.
That's true, Madam Chair. We do have Amy Goldsmith. Anime Goldsmith from the Department of Law is available for any questions.
Okay, and I believe this is for the intrastate. Okay, so Mrs. Goldsmith, if you would go ahead and explain that to us so that we all understand that. And before you answer that, I want the record to show that Representative Lynn and Representative Feige have joined us. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Anne Mae Goldsmith. I'm an Assistant Attorney General representing the Department of Transportation. Interstate and intrastate commerce with respect to commercial motor vehicles is defined in the federal regulations, and they define interstate commerce as trade, traffic, or transportation between a state and a place outside the state, or between two places in a state through another state or a place outside the United States, or between two places in a state as part of trade or traffic or transportation originating or terminating outside the state. So the definition of interstate commerce is fairly clear, but then their definition of intrastate commerce is simply any trade, traffic, or transportation in a state that is not included in interstate commerce. So they kind of leave the distinction a little bit fuzzy. Nevertheless, the new version of the bill, I don't think there's any legal issue with it. The federal regs very specifically allow states to deregulate intrastate commercial motor vehicles up to 26,000 pounds. So the 19,500 pound limit that this bill sets is totally within what the federal regs allow for.
Okay, thank you very much. And that I'm sorry that Representative Johnson isn't here because he had that was a big concern of his. But I'm glad that that has been taken care of. And also now let's go. I think you have Daniel Smith online. And Daniel Smith with our Department of Transportation,
Commercial Enforcement Division.
Okay. Daniel Smith, can you hear us?
Yes, I am on, and I'm available for any questions that you may have also.
Okay, well, I guess then the question that I would have is that we've changed it and put the deadline at 19.5, and that was because we didn't want to get into more of a safety question about air brakes. Can you comment on that?
Sure. When we look at classifying vehicles, we use the Federal Highway Administration vehicle classification. Last year, HB 15 exempted up to 14,000 pounds. Those are the pickups, vans, one and two axle trailers. The next class up is Class 4, which is buses. And now pushing this up to the higher weight, we're actually looking at Class 5 vehicles, two axle single units that are generally used in commerce, but it's a much harder use on those vehicles. So the challenge for us on the enforcement side is we can look at a pickup truck, what we were trying to exempt last year, and say that's clearly a pickup truck, and it's outside of our authority or our regulations. As we push these weights up, it's extremely hard for enforcement officers now to be able to look at these other trucks, box trucks, flatbed trucks that will be used in commerce, and we have no idea of knowing whether it's an interstate movement or intrastate movement just by looking at the vehicle. So I think it was much clearer last year that we were looking at pickups and vans. When you look at two-axle single-unit trucks, those are typically the ones that are used running around town, box vans and such, that it'd be extremely hard for enforcement to identify as intrastate commerce simply by the vehicle class.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any I guess what I hear you saying is you'd rather have it that leave it at 14,000?
Madam Chair, we leave it at your discretion, but as far as enforcement purposes, it will be considerably harder. We get complaints right now because we stop somebody who is intrastate and they're not over the threshold, and it's much clearer to identify. This will make it much harder, other than if we can clearly identify these vehicles by the marking requirements that we know, yes, this is an interstate vehicle, then they'll be subject to inspection.
Okay, thank you, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Smith, for being on the phone. In your discussions with my staff earlier, it seemed that you were much more favorable for this as a simplified way to help the inspection process go. In intrastate, what we're doing is to help folks from point of origin, or in this case, farmers or craftsmen or whoever might have this box on the back of this 550 equivalent chassis, to be able to conduct business. Now, if it's a commercial vehicle, they will, and especially interstate, won't they have to still have the GVW on it, and it would be much more clear that this is, it'll have those markings, the ownership, and et cetera, that your folks would be looking for. Whereas now in an intrastate, we're just saying that that's not necessarily necessary anymore. Isn't that correct? And that those markings
through the chair. I believe, yes, you are correct. We can use those markings, and that would be the USDOT number, which establishes that operating authorities for us to identify those vehicles. I guess with respect to my comments earlier, when we were asking the division or department's opinion, it was specifically the other CS, not this version that is before us today. As far as my remarks that may have been more favorable, it was more pointed toward the earlier version that we were speaking about.
Madam Chair?
Representative Isaacson?
Thank you. My understanding, though, is that this was considered a much more universal way of addressing a problem, and so it would be actually easier for enforcement. So that's how I recollect it with the staff. And well, as Madam Chair was talking about, we had started this so that we could help dealers and fabricating, and then one of our committee members had concerned that that might start in a lawsuit, because we might be giving a preferential treatment to, say, an Anchorage fabricator over a Seattle fabricator, and so this would cure that. And then the issues were that there are other folks who use, as pickup trucks get bigger and bigger, they use this chassis for any number of applications and are not necessarily in the commercial. This would not be for commercial passenger, 16-plus passenger applications. That would still be considered commercial. So in many ways, as I talked to Department of Law and staff has talked to you, it looked like this was going to be a much more simple, universal way of treating an issue so that your folks don't have to have these folks stop in the weigh station. It saves your people time, and we know in the northern region you're short on staff. So for all these purposes, are we still on track? For Mr. Smith.
Representative Isaacson through the chair. I guess we're weighing pros and cons. Certainly the staffing issue that we have, employee retention, attracting the employees that want to do this work is certainly challenging, specifically in the northern region. So with that respect, I do believe we can target on, we can focus on the vehicles that are clearly CMVs requiring a CDL over 26,001 pounds. I do believe strongly in the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, and as you creep up to the higher weights, now these vehicles should probably have additional scrutiny on them. Initially, the CS spoke about fire extinguisher, and that maybe that the fire extinguisher needed to be on the vehicle but not mounted. And coming from the enforcement side, when you look at a vehicle at 19,500 pounds and it collides with a vehicle at 4,000 or 5,000 pounds like I drive, the big vehicle always wins. And then that fire extinguisher, you know, it not being secured is a larger problem because it's coming from a much larger, heavier vehicle. So that's where I'm trying to frame this. I don't think you're way off base, no, because we certainly have the realities of trying to do this enforcement work. However, I believe in the motor carrier safety regulations, and that's really the angle that I come at this from. Let's approach it with a solution, trying to find a solution that makes sense without being overly burdensome on industry.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, you're still on track with it overall.
You know what, Abe Thompson's is with the Alaska Trucking Association, so he's online. So let's hear what Abe has to say. He might be able to enlighten us a little bit more. Abe, are you there?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am here.
Well, go ahead and tell us your affiliation and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Abe Thompson, the Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association, and the Alaska Trucking Association is a statewide organization representing the interests of our more than 200 members from Faro to Ketchikan. Freight movement represents a large chunk of our economy and impacts all of us each and every day. The simple truth is that if you got it, a truck brought it. During the last legislative session, I testified in favor of House Bill 15, which increased the weight threshold for intrastate commercial vehicles for purposes of commercial vehicle regulation and inspection from 10,000 pounds to 14,000 pounds. Our reasoning at the time was that these smaller vehicles of 14,000 pounds or less were falling into the then definition of a commercial motor vehicle of greater than 10,000 pounds that had historically not been considered commercial vehicles, such as pickup trucks, small step vans, and small trailers. The CS for House Bill 260 before you proposes to change the definition of what have traditionally been considered medium-duty commercial vehicles to medium-duty non-commercial vehicles. These are the local pickup and delivery trucks, some household goods movers trucks, some of the larger equipment trucks, mechanic trucks, things like that, boom trucks, some tow trucks, and other vehicles larger than the Class 3 that were dealt with last year. As we discussed last year, we feel that Class 3 vehicles do not require the level of scrutiny that the larger 4 and through 5 classes require. The Class 4 or 5 trucks between 14,001 and 19,500 pounds do require a higher level of maintenance and inspection due to their heavier use. as with last year, safety is our very first concern. The streets and highways of Alaska are where our drivers go to work every day, and we want to do our very best to provide a safe workplace for our employees and our contractors. While the argument can be made that there is no statistical basis for drawing the conclusion that intrastate operators are less safe than interstate carriers, I submit to you that DOT simply does not have the data upon which to draw a conclusion about these carriers. I've been provided lists of inter- and intrastate carriers that operate in Alaska. There are more than 874 interstate motor carriers in Alaska, and of those 874, 124 have 10 trucks or more, and 373 operate only one truck. There are more than 4,570 intrastate motor carriers in Alaska, and of those 4,570, 285 have 10 trucks or more, and 2,176 operate only one truck. And the data I just presented to you is about 2 years old and does not take into account the trucks that were eliminated from regulation by the passage of House Bill 15 last year. It seems only fair that vehicles of similar size and use either in interstate or intrastate should be held to the same standard to the greatest possible. It seems that this bill is trying to fix a problem that does not require the deregulation of safety requirements for a large portion of the truck population in Alaska. On behalf of the Alaska Trucking Association, I urge you to oppose this bill, and I will try to answer questions, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Aves. The figures where you said there was 874, that was interstate, right?
I'm sorry, say again, Madam Chair?
The 874 different companies that operated in the state, that was interstate, right?
Interstate, yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, and I just didn't get the figures for the intrastate. So could you, the total amount?
Sure.
Okay, if you'd repeat them.
Okay, there are more than 4,570 intrastate motor carriers in Alaska, those that have DOT numbers. And of those 4,570, 285 have 10 trucks or more, and 2,176 operate only one truck, and the balance operate between 10 and 1.
Okay, and do you have any idea how many of those are state trucks, like for DOT, and because they have bunches of them and stuff? Do you have any idea?
This is only commercial vehicles that have been issued U.S. DOT numbers.
Okay.
These are privately owned, not government vehicles.
Just giving everyone a little bit of time to look at those numbers and see what they think about them. Representative Gaddis.
Is it possible to have a very refined summary of what the bill, I mean, we've been down some different trails, and I was hoping that the bill sponsor could give us a really short version again to remind us what this bill did do? Again, with its changes and our full discussion, because I kind of have forgotten. I mean, I've got the main gist of it, that vehicles come in from the lower 48 and that they get refurbished somewhere along the way and they get to final destination and potentially sold or paid for. But quite frankly, I forget the reason that there's an advantage to have this bill. I apologize. So if you could, again, just real short.
I Representative Isaacson, if you would just forget the changes now. We've got this bill before us, and it's version R. And just what does version R do?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Version R simply removes, it allows the intrastate movement of vehicles up to 19,500 pounds without being classified as commercial, meaning it doesn't have to have the DOT inspection, that identifies the end user. It doesn't have to have the gross vehicle weight, which may change with application and ownership. It doesn't have to have as correctly stated, it wouldn't have to have some of the safety equipment permanently mounted. And it doesn't require things like logbooks and medical certifications and so forth. It would allow movement of vehicles from, say, Port of Anchorage to points elsewhere in Alaska without running the risk of preferential treatment to Alaska drivers over fabricators over outside fabricators if they were indeed being remodified in Alaska.
Okay, and then if I may ask, are there, I'm big on this year, unintended consequences? Is there anything that you know of that would be a problem or anything?
Madam Chair, as I also am very conscientious of just trying to solve actual problems and not anticipated problems, the first draft of the bill was just that, but then the unintended consequence was what was revealed. And so as we change this to be able to reflect more global application, the points that Aves brought up, for example, the points that Mr. Smith brought up, those could be some of the problems of this side. Do those outweigh the benefits? I'm not sure for the application that those problems are going to outweigh the benefits. I think there are more benefits to this than drawback, because by far the kind of application, if you look at the pictures, you'll find it, yes, there is commercial application up on the North Slope or by handyman and so forth, but a lot of times it's just folks who might be agriculture, might be any number of things. That's the type of user we're trying to protect. There's nobody who's going to go up against one of the big moving companies, for example, with a 550 frame and successfully compete against them. So I don't think that this would be the business model that's going to conflict in large part with the safety issues mentioned by the Alaska Trucking Association. I think that these vehicles are on the road in large part and by people who know how to drive them. And there are other states that allow this intrastate application. As a matter of fact, many of them go all the way up to 26,000 pounds. I didn't feel that the problem that we're trying to address warranted or needed going up to that amount. And so I'm just addressing the problems that have been brought up to me since the passage of the bill last year by folks who didn't realize that that was in motion and could have jumped on the bandwagon, as it were, last year.
Thank you. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I understood it, the original purpose of the bill was basically to enable ferrying vehicles to Fairbanks and points beyond. Okay. During those ferry trips, were they taking on cargo or were they transporting passengers?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, in those ferrying trips, they are not considered carrying any commercial equipment or ferrying passengers, other than maybe immediate family or employees, multiple employees.
Okay, then looking at page 1 of version R, line 7, it seems to me that the very operation that you're trying to help is already excluded under existing statute. So the only effect that the bill in front of that I see in front of me is to eliminate inspections on vehicles that are being used for transportation of passengers and cargo commercially. You're eliminating the inspections up to vehicle weights of 19.5.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, I believe you're hitting on a very important point. Yes, but DOT regulations require, as you heard Mr. Smith say, that they still have to look to make sure certain regulatory compliances are met, and this will free up that those regulatory requirements that have been built from statute. This simplifies it, in my understanding, and as he testified. Other than he may not be able to see, other than the markings as required on a genuinely commercial vehicle, it has to have painted on the side who owns it, and the gross vehicle weight, et cetera, and the DOT number.
And follow up, Representative Feige.
Okay, for the vehicles used strictly in intrastate commerce is where this 19.5, I think I'm hearing kind of conflicting things here. Are we reducing the safety of those vehicles below 19.5 in intrastate commerce? Or are there other regulations somewhere else that supersede that?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, I hear you asking, is one of the unintended consequences that certain safety equipment won't be required on these vehicles unless they are considered commercial?
Well, first of all, the way you're amending the existing law is you're removing requirements instead of below 14,000 pounds, now below 19.5.
Correct.
And those requirements, as I understand it, include certain pieces of safety equipment. And that's not just for ferrying operations, because ferrying operations already fall outside of this particular paragraph.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, that may be one of those unintended consequences that the chair asked about. If it is the will of this body not to pass version R, the CS for House Bill 260, and revert back to the original, which was version, I believe, P, no, it wasn't, version, I don't know, whatever it was, what was it? Then we could go that route. But what I would ask is it better for us to have a benefit that is going to affect the greatest number of people and also allow for the greatest amount of safety? I believe from the discussions that staff and I have had with the various parties engaged in this and with the Department of Law that this would still allow a quantifiable amount of public safety. It's when you go over that and you start getting into other equipment, and I think that's what part of the testimony you heard was by the truckers, when you get into air brakes and others, you're starting to get into areas that there's a lot more maintenance, and maybe the regular driver, recreational driver, isn't going to be equipped to handle. I myself wouldn't have a vehicle I'm not totally equipped to handle, but on the other hand, even with my little Ford Ranger, I take it into the shop on a regular basis to get fixed or to be maintained. So in that instance, the majority of the users, as I understood it, at this vehicle level of Ford 550 or equivalent, it's not going to have that many safety issues, depending on what you put on the back. Again, yes, this started off as trying to fix a particular problem. We discovered there would be other problems, and this seemed to be the most global fix to help regulatory issues.
Okay. Daniel Smith, are you still online?
Madam Chair, yes, I am.
Okay, I have a question for you. I realize that you said there may be times that it's a little hard to keep track of who's who, but do you feel, because I'm wanting to know for sure, do you feel that this bill, because it goes up to 19.5, do you feel that that jeopardizes the safety of people out there on the highways? That's my biggest concern, and could you answer that?
Madam Chair, to answer that question would look at our operations as far as commercial vehicle enforcement goes, and it's all really hinged on two things. That's infrastructure protection and safety. So as we move larger and larger in these vehicles, now as the definition changes, we're having to look at, is it the will of you guys to say the definition of commercial vehicle for intrastate commerce is 19,501 pounds, a much larger vehicle that then would not have to stop at an open way station or have any of the safety requirements. Every one of the motor carrier safety regulations really was written because something bad happened. And so we're looking at all kinds of unintended consequences when you don't know what it's going to be like when this section goes unregulated. For instance, load securement is very spelled out. If you're a commercial vehicle and you have a load of X size, depending on its characteristics, we will have guidance as far as how many straps need to be on that. Once it is unregulated, it will be up to the operator of that vehicle that may or may not have that knowledge to decide what they want on their vehicle as far as safety equipment or load securement items on those vehicles. So I believe there are many unintended consequences as these vehicles do get larger and larger and are unregulated, because the same vehicle that the person is engaged in interstate commerce with will have to have all of those items for us to consider them safe vehicles operating on the road.
Okay, thank you very much. We do have someone in the audience that would like to testify. Barbara Huff, would you please come forward?
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I actually, when House Bill 260, for the record, Barbara Huff Technus, I'm Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959, and we actually represent a few truck drivers. When the initial bill, House Bill 260, was actually introduced, we did go through, didn't have too many concerns with it. It seemed to have an impact on a very, very small segment. The CS has huge, we're very, very concerned about the impact on the safety out there and the thousands of additional trucks that are going to be put on the road. And I think the earlier testimony, even for our guys, the safety for the motoring public is huge. And when you start looking at our roads with the icy conditions and just the sheer nature in our state, even compared to other states in the lower 48, these are Class 5 trucks. And I don't know if you've taken a look. You can actually go online and they'll show you the different Class 5. They're good-sized pieces of equipment that potentially are going to be, unfortunately, unregulated if this does move forward. So we would go on record opposed to the CS for House Bill 260. Thank you.
Now, I have a question. So I'm trying to get down to the nitty-gritty of this to find out would this allow businesses to, would it be cheaper for businesses with this bill, and why? I think that's what we're trying to do here, is make it so that they don't have to have as many rules and regulations. And what happens along that line? What makes a difference there?
Well, I don't know how accurate this, what I'm about to say, because I don't believe that it would necessarily be true or applicable for all commercial companies out there, but I guess part of the cost of doing business is making sure that you're driving safe equipment. Unregulating, does one assume that because they no longer fall under the regulations, that they don't have to follow the same rules? I mean, legally, they no longer have to follow those rules. And that, from a safety perspective, I guess you could save money by not, how do I want to say this, following those very important safety rules and regulations out there.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
If I could. Thank you. So, thank you for being here today. And so the original version, you don't mind because it has a specific application.
It was very specific, yes.
So, is, in your minds, that still good to move forward, and the risk to interstate, do you think that there would be a lawsuit that we might be giving fabricators in Anchorage an unfair advantage then over a fabricator in Seattle or Los Angeles?
I don't know that I'm in a position to answer that particular question, although I, through the chair, Representative Isaacson, Representative Feige's comment with respect to the commerce, if these individuals, and my understanding when they were actually moving these vehicles under the original bill, they were not involved in commercial commerce. So I would think under the current law they would be exempt. But I'm not an attorney and probably not the individual to speak specifically to that.
Thank you. I'll speak to that directly.
You know what? There's some questions here that maybe need to be
retooled,
looked at a little bit better, a little bit closer. So why don't we let you maybe work it out with DOT and with the departments that are overseeing the enforcement part you know, I don't know what can be done, but why don't you see if you guys can come to a little bit of a better of a agreement? Because we've got right now we have before us the CS of version R, and so that's the document that we're working from. And you're talking about moving different, doing something else. So why don't you go back and when's the next time we can hear this bill again? Next Tuesday. So that's just Tuesday.
Thursday. Madam
Tuesday.
Chair. All right. Before I, and I appreciate being able to do that, if could I just comment on the one question that Representative Feige had that Barbara's mentioned?
Yes.
Okay. So the idea of Section 1, it says a commercial motor vehicle means self-propelled, and then it has three things that are contingent. It's used for transporting passengers or property for commercial, and it also is on the highway, and that's the important part, and it has a certain weight restriction. And so that's what we were trying to address with the CS. But I will take it back and talk to the parties again and make sure that we have something that actually addresses these concerns, and I very much appreciate that.
Okay, thank you. And now we'll set that aside and let you guys work on it. And then now we'll move on up to the next bill, and that is House Bill 271, the Feasibility Study to Extend the Railroad to Dead Horse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record again, I'm Representative Doug Isaacson.
Oh, you know what? And yes. I'm going to close testimony on that right now, and then if we have to, we can open it up. But I'm going to close testimony on that.
On 260.
On 260. All right.
Okay. So, since our this is our second hearing on HB 21, I'll keep my remarks brief. Included some new information in your packets, including a copy of the PowerPoint, an academic paper by Dr. Metz, which highlights a number of the resources that could be accessed if this rail was built. Last year, my chief of staff, former mayor of the Denali Borough, now USPELI employee again, Dave Tallarico, and I looked at a statewide map of resources. And we calculated if just 10% of those resources were put into active mines, we could bring in approximately $18 billion worth of revenue into our state treasury without changing any of our tax structures. And DNR has confirmed that we're not far off the mark. One of the pieces that is also in front of you is an email that we received today. And this is from Great Bear Petroleum Operating LLC. And they say the project could provide significant transportation cost savings for delivering materials. And the rest you can read. But I want to highlight that this has many, many applications. And they even say that the railroad extension could provide another option for North Slope product delivery to in-state locations or tidewater. So I ask for your support on and passage of this. Hopefully it's looked at all the angles and is not contentious. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And public testimony is still open on this bill. We didn't close it last time. And we do have someone that is online that would like to testify, Paul Metz.
Yes, Madam Chair, this is Paul Metz.
Okay, tell us who you are affiliated with and then give us your testimony.
My address is 3510 Rosa Creek Road, Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm employed with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I really don't want to take up a lot of your time. I've provided this report to Representative Isaacson and a PowerPoint presentation that I've made to the Alaska Rail Master Planning Committee and members of DOT, as well as the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce with respect to the benefits of extending the Alaska Railroad to the North Slope. And you all have a copy, I believe, of that report in front of you. If there are any questions about that, I'd be willing to answer them. As I say, I don't want to take up any of your precious time this afternoon, but I will be available to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any questions, and we do have it in front of us. I'm trying to look to see how many pages there were. Several pages, I guess, 10, 11, 12 pages. 13 pages, and we do have that. And thank you very much for testifying, and we do have someone else online. Vice President of the Engineers Engineering for the Alaska Railroad, Clark Hopp.
Yes, Madam Chair. I was just making myself available if there were any questions.
All right. Don't see any questions. Any discussion on this? See no more questions. I will close public testimony. So public testimony is closed. And any discussions on this bill from the committee? Representative Christ Tompkins.
When I was little, I used to draw lines on the map for roads and railroads I'd like to see built. It was sort of my hobby when I was about 6 and 8 and probably all the way up until middle school. It always fascinated me. That said, with the idea of drawing a very big, very significant line that would represent a huge investment of infrastructure in Alaska to the North Slope, which is a very intriguing, compelling idea to me, the price tag on the feasibility study is really big. And my question or comment is, if there is feasibility and an economic imperative for the North Slope oil industry or mineral development, why is private industry not already explored or put at least some initial investment into exploring the economic feasibility of building or extending the railroad north? That's the point that I get caught on.
And I think probably my thoughts on that are is that because Alaska does not have a plan, that kind of leaves private industry up in the air of what is even possible. And we're in this committee here to look at the policy, to see what we think is best for the state overall, and then I guess the financial part we pass on to the finance committee. But there's no problem with verbalizing those concerns in this committee, because that's part of the unintended consequences sometimes. So I don't have a problem with you mentioning that. Follow-up?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have difficulty subscribing to the philosophy that the Transportation Committee can't consider the finances of where we're going to spend and invest our money, because that seems to be the fundamental policy of transportation, is where we're going to invest and not invest. And I mean, the difficulty is if we spend $2 million exploring the feasibility of a railroad to Dead Horse, because $2 million we're not spending on the Northern Rail Extension or the Port McKenzie Port and Rail Extension. I mean, we've got limited money, and it's a zero-sum game. So that's the sort of decision that gets me. I just want to make sure that we have limited funds. We're kind of running out of money in the state of Alaska, and I just want to make sure that we're putting these substantial sums of money where we're going to get the best return.
And I don't have a problem talking about that, because I think that's important that we look at reality, and so that is something that we need to think about. Any other comments? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of agree with the representative from Sitka. $2 million is a lot of money. There hasn't really been a whole lot of, other than one email from Great Bear. Great Bear's, quite frankly, got a long way to go before we can even say that they're going to be developing those areas. And maybe that's something that should get fleshed out, but I guess for the type of operation and the quantities that they're dealing with in terms of fracking sand and steel and all that, we have barges that we can put those supplies on. You know, railroads are designed to carry lots of really heavy stuff cheaply. And, to go make the investment, which I think reading through this was something like a $5 billion investment to build a railroad, and certainly the Alaska Railroad doesn't have the capitalization to do that. There's got to be a significant economic driver that's going to result in lots of heavy stuff moving from point A to point B. Now, someday that may be oil. I could see, production gets so low on the North Slope that they have to move it by rail instead of by a pipeline. I expect that's a long ways down the road. The mines in the Livengood area, mines in the Ambler Mining District, certainly those are potential customers. But I think not all to the stage yet where we need to. Yeah, it's great in concept, and maybe a shorter line is a way to start out that way. But I think, there hasn't, like I said, there hasn't been a whole lot of industry. Of all the potential customers, we've essentially heard from one. We do have a study. Granted, it's 1969, 1970 vintage study. But the mountains haven't moved a whole lot since then. And that particular route through Attigan Pass with a tunnel and all, that certainly could be an adequate route. but it's not our job to provide money to study things just because we think they need studying. It's got to be a reasonable expectation that, you know, something like that is going to go forward. So it's also not our job to basically come up with welfare type projects to keep university researchers engaged. And I think this is kind of how I view this particular decision is, you know, do I want to just dump another $2 million into the university for something they could probably devote their intellect and their efforts someplace that would get us a much more immediate return?
Representative Gaddis.
And Madam Chair, I have to echo Representative Feige's comments. I guess in our declining dollars, if you will, that I think it's real important that we not study something that I know a lot of my constituents have complained about is we do a lot of studies but not furthering it with an actual project, and I'm reluctant to have another study that does that. I would rather put our dollars at this point into projects that we haven't finished yet. So I won't be voting for this.
I think I'm going to have a brief at ease. Okay. Is there anyone else that has any questions or would like to have any more discussion? Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just address this, and then I'm going to ask that maybe we hold this over while I get a few more of these points fine-tuned. But when we're looking at declining revenues, we have to be frugal with how we spend money. Absolutely. But if we don't start doing what is very necessary to get new revenue, and folks, we are so addicted to oil, that's all we can see. And oil is declining in its revenue stream, so we need to diversify. So I would just say, because this can help with getting new oil, this can help with getting new mines open, this can help with expanding other economic opportunities for the state, that this would be a very, very, very good use of money. Now, as to university welfare, no, it is not university welfare. I addressed DOT and asked, can you do this for this much money in this short of time so that we can get something going quickly? And the answer was, not really. So when you look at how much money we're spending, it's not as much as if we wanted our departments to do it. And Murray Walsh is here, and if we want, we could talk, but I'll bring this back for you, and we'll get all this stuff hashed out. But the idea that that this is an expense that business should do, as we look at all of our transportation studies, oftentimes it is the state that first invests, and then the industry says, oh, you're doing this. It's kind of like when we have a bill up and no one knows about it till it's after the fact. And then all of a sudden everybody says, wow, I didn't know we could do this. What this does, it heightens the awareness in the resource development community that the state of Alaska is serious about diversifying economy and making sure that they have access to the type of transportation systems necessary to haul heavy, awkward loads. And that's what this does. Now, Dr. Metz has the study. Perhaps I should have had him outline it, because one of the drawbacks of being brief is that we don't go line by line and remind ourselves of the benefit. And Madam Chair, there is a four-page little brief on this, but I would remind the committee that when you look at an opportunity that is weighed very carefully by someone who has been involved with Point McKenzie, who's been involved with the G7G in Canada, and been involved with, over the years, many engineering studies for different administrations and different legislatures and different organizations, and he comes up and says, we could have a 30% return on investment from just one application of this railroad, and gee, if this is true, shouldn't we go after it? Now, Is that worth $2 million to get a 30% return on investment? I think so. Because right now our railroad is staggeringly suffering under, well, suffering under staggering news that not only is its revenues declining because Flint Hills and Yosemite are constrained, but now Flint Hills is even more constrained. And this month, for the first time, Madam Chair, they have not elected to take any fuel in April, which means that the 15% total revenue the railroad was getting from Flint Hills is going to be drastically reduced. And we are going to be asked to help prop up the railroad with far more than $2 million. And ladies and gentlemen of this committee, I would much prefer that we had revenues that we could project in the future coming in, and that the railroad would be able to get back up on its feet so it doesn't have to be dependent on just one economy. This is a great opportunity. I will go home, Madam Chair, go back to the office. I will crank out a simplified bullet sheet letting the committee remember why it is important that this bill pass and the benefits to our state if it should be proven right. And for $2 million, it would go out to get revenue bonds. It would go out and get private money to build it. It would not be state money that builds it, because if the proof of concept pans out, we don't need to put general fund. We don't need to put capital money into that. It'll drive itself. But we do need to start by proving the concept. We do need to say to the bond markets, we do need to say to the parties concerned, this is viable, and get them excited and get them on board. It starts with this. This is not to welfare. This is for a university. This is welfare, the general welfare of the state. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson. Representative Lynn, do you have a question?
When I say a question, just a comment, I would basically echo Representative Isaacson's comments on this thing. No one is going to do anything about a railroad extension to any place, including what we're talking about here, unless there's some kind of a study that verifies that, in fact, it's feasible. So, you know, which comes first, the chicken or the egg thing? I think we need, I wouldn't want to say lay the egg for progress, but I mean, there's tremendous potential here up there, and as Reverend Isaacson said, oil is important, of course, but so the place is just rich with the development of it, and nobody's going to go any place with it. And if we can get some kind of a rail link up there in the reasonable future, that's going to spur eventually, with coming down there, maybe the connection someday to the lower 48, which I desperately would like. But this has more importance than trying to go to the lower 48 now. And so I hope we can bring this back and look at it again. But look at all the studies we've had on the gas pipeline. I don't know what's going to happen on that, but we're closer to it than we've ever been before, because we're in serious debate and discussion of a potential pipeline, maybe during my lifetime, and which at my age, I'd like to see. My life is not that long, maybe. So let's look at this and evaluate it carefully, and do what needs to be done.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Gaddis.
Can I just make a comment on that? Yes, I think that we have at times done things without studying them, and they have become boondoggles. So I'm not stating that a study isn't important, and that I do understand that sometimes we have to spend money to make money. We do have to build infrastructure so that we can make money. So I get that part. I guess right here in this committee at this time, I didn't hear the compelling reason to go forward. And so I would have to agree with my namesake, Representative Lynn, that it is important to
Lynn's have to stick together.
That's right. but I don't think so at this time is where I was coming from. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, and I don't see any other comments. So what we'll do next Tuesday, and I did misspeak earlier, because next Tuesday we're going to hear from the Port of Anchorage. So we will be meeting jointly with the Senate. So it'll be next Thursday. I certainly hope that we will be able to bring both these bills up again. So having said that, we're adjourned.